You're listening to Screen Heroes.
Hey everyone, welcome back to the Screen Heroes podcast. I am your host, Derek, and I have with me my two longtime lovely co-hosts, Ryan.
Hello.
And Ray.
Hi.
Hello, hello. Welcome back. Episode 241. This week, we are actually kind of doing a retro review of 2009's Watchmen film, which is also a Zack Snyder film. We are doing the Snyder Cut next week in our double bonus week, where we'll be doing two episodes. We'll be releasing an episode for Zack Snyder's Justice League, and we'll also be doing an episode for the premiere of The Falcon and the Winter Soldier. So you've got two episodes from us next week. Just want to get that out there, get that out of the way. We're doing live streams Monday and Tuesday next week, and then the episode will come out the following day, so a Tuesday and Wednesday release for new episodes, which, you know, if that's your thing, then, you know, cool. It's something that I'm excited about.
Yeah.
So this week, we're not really doing news. We're going to kind of skip over news. Ray, was there anything else you wanted to do before we talk about the movie?
No, not really. I have bonus questions for you guys for during the movie, things that we don't usually get to talk about. So it's just more movie. It's, you know, expansion.
Interesting.
It's the ultimate cut.
Okay. All right. Fair enough. So for those who want to know exactly what we're talking about for Watchmen, there are three cuts of the movie, or three versions, if you will. We have decided to go with the theatrical cut for two main reasons. One, that is the version that's available on HBO Max if you were going to stream it, and it is the shortest of those three cuts, and it's already 2 hours and 42 minutes. It's already not that short of a film. The director's cut's over 3 hours, and the ultimate cut's even longer. So that's what we're doing. So I guess then this is your spoiler warning for Watchmen 2009, if you haven't seen it and are unfamiliar with the graphic novel, then, you know, you have been warned officially.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So let's kick things off here. Where would you guys like to start?
I mean, maybe we should give our overall thoughts of the film now versus when we first watched it, or if it's changed, or, you know, I don't know. What do you guys think?
That's a good plan.
Did you all see it when it was released in theaters?
I did.
I saw the Blue Dawn cut, yes.
Yes, the elusive fourth cut of the movie. Yeah. Though there was a lot more blue penis in this cut than I had remembered them keeping in.
Yeah, it was mostly just the large blue penises that they cut out.
Yeah.
If it was a normal size Dr. Manhattan, sure, we could have a little peen here, but no, whenever he was giant, there was no peen.
Interesting. I wonder if there's some type of MPAA rule about that, where as long as
the penis has to be less than human size or something, like smaller than an actual human.
I'm sure that that's not how the rule is written, but maybe there is some kind of rule about it can't be portrayed in a particular size. I don't know.
Okay, so I want to point out that according to Adam Ruins Everything, that man does his homework, the MPAA does not have any set of rules. It is a small group of Americans that review these things, and they kind of just make it up as they go. Now, there are some guidelines that they follow, but those are just based on who's on the committee and who's not. And so what we got away with 10 years is different than now, and it always depends on who's reviewing it. There's no decency committee that judges this stuff or says you're only allowed this amount and this
this many inches of penis.
Well, just for an example, in the early 2000s, a PG-13 movie was allowed one F word before they got bumped to R. And that's not the case anymore. They're not really allowed any. If you pay attention, PG-13 movies instead will say shit at least like 5 or 6 times, but no more F words. So it changes with who's ever on the committee. And it's only about, 20 people that decide these films. So it's kind of bullshit. It's like, to me, it feels very McCarthyism or, Red Scare, Salem Witch Trials, where a bunch of people are just like, you know what? That's suspicious. R.
But then the studios can be like, oh, I wanted to be PG-13. Here's a little extra monies. Mm-hmm. Maybe you can forget I used that third shit in there.
They can completely bribe them or, get around things like Derek points out almost every time I watch it that Klingons have purple blood in Undiscovered Country, because if they had red blood, it would have been rated R. Like, how bonkers ridiculous is that? Do you think like kids really care either
way?
And
that's happened in a lot of movies. I mean, mm-hmm. they use Suicide Squad, they use black blood when you blow up all those creatures because mm-hmm. red blood would have made it I don't know, thinking it's another rating. Was that thing PG-13? I can't remember.
It was.
Yeah.
So, it's pretty weird. Common.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a strange thing. The Star Trek one's just a good example because of the way Star Trek canon is set up. Now that race just has that color of blood because that was the first time they ever showed it. And it's a little silly because, our kids looking at it, like, I knew it was blood. I knew it wasn't human blood, but it was still blood. So what's the difference? But...
And
I don't know.
It's to be confusing. Honest, okay, all those like bubble putties in Suicide Squad, like, do you think it would have been more just violent in your eyes if it was like red viscera versus black?
I think it's silly, but it's the same reason why, like in the Avengers movies, the Chitauri, they're just this faceless army that they can slaughter, and it's fine for PG-13. But if it was a bunch of humans, I don't think you can keep a PG-13 rating at that point.
Right.
Right. So, well, it's weird.
The whole point behind Dr. Manhattan, and it's twofold. Like, one, it's how Dave Gibbons and Alan Moore wrote the character. Dr. Manhattan is disconnected from humans and he believes himself superior. He's outside of it. So a superior being, what do they have to be ashamed about? Like like he doesn't need them as protection. So he's not covering anything from the elements, but he also doesn't need to hide anything. He's the most powerful.
He's beyond any of that crap. Mm-hmm. He's beyond caring.
There's that. And then two, Zack Snyder said that he wanted to include it because there is a standard for, it's just women nudity in movies is much higher than male nudity, and boobs in movies can still be in PG-13 and stuff, but as soon as you see like a butt, I think it becomes R or something like that. I don't know.
I think
again,
you can show butts.
There aren't guidelines.
In PG-13, yeah.
Yeah, Splash. That was PG, I'm pretty sure there was butt in it.
Well, it's really
that's
hard to
older,
go back
though.
To the '80s.
Yeah. Because Ghostbusters would not be PG if there had been a PG-13 rating at the time.
No, we say that a lot. We use that a lot because it's very obvious from the cursing and the blowjob scene that it would have had a PG-13 rating and not PG. But his point was this, he was trying to even the playing field a bit, more male nudity in rated R movies.
I will say this. So I saw it opening night, pretty big theater, very full. And there were a couple of... I'm going to say middle-aged women. I don't really know their age, but probably 30s or 40s when I was seeing this. And they thought the blue penis was the funniest thing they had ever seen in their entire lives and would completely cackle, laugh at it every single time it was on screen, which got annoying pretty quickly since the original version of the film showed it all the time.
Yeah.
So, you know, it was better this time not having that as part of my experience.
So I actually enjoyed the movie less now than I did back in 2009. There are things that were changes
too.
I did not like as much now as I did back then. And I have watched it in between, but I think I was watching the ultimate cut. Not the one with the like Black Freighter stuff in it. Just the one without that.
So that's the director's cut.
Director's cut, sorry. Which is better, but it's still, I found myself finding more inherent problems with the changes and the way the movie was shot than I did in 2009, which I thought was interesting because this movie, I would consider it to be one of my favorite comic book movies before this. And now I question whether like it breaks the top 10 even. So
interesting.
So what changes are you talking about? What did you have issues with?
Changes between, when I say changes, I'm talking about changes between the graphic novel and between that and the movie, not necessarily changes between like the director's cut. So I think that first of all, it's amazing that Zack Snyder was able to even make this movie because a lot of people consider this to be unmakeable. Nobody could actually like put this movie to a movie length film that maybe a mini series or something, but that a lot of people consider it not able to be done.
Yeah, a lot of directors passed on it because they considered it unfilmable.
Well, especially at the time, the opportunity to do a rated R comic book flick, superhero flick, was more or less considered a bad idea. Mm-hmm. We didn't have Deadpool yet to confirm that it could be done very successfully. And I mean, Deadpool also had a very tight budget too, where this did not.
Yeah, R-rated superhero movies were not like a thing back then, and even with this one, it wasn't hugely like it wasn't Deadpool successful.
No, it was actually considered to not be a financial success because of the cost involved and everything like that. And I mean, back then, I mean, movies didn't. The average superhero movie wasn't making the kind of money that they are now. That just wasn't really the way it was yet. So this movie had a production budget of $138 million. Which is about 40 million more, 40, 50 million more than Deadpool had. And then it only brought in total worldwide 187 million. So it did like, that's it. And it's only made about 150 million in like DVD Blu-ray sales. So if you combine all of that, it's still not really considered financially successful.
Yeah. And that's crazy to me because I was very much seeing the trailer for this movie made me go, holy crap, what is this? And I went out and read the graphic novel before the movie came out, just after seeing the trailer, because I thought it looked interesting. But I digress. Back to the point of the points that I didn't like. And maybe you'll argue with me about this. Derek probably will because he likes to argue with me, but maybe you'll agree. Have you both read the graphic novel?
A long, long time ago, but I read it before the movie came out. I have not read it since.
And Rachel, I'm pretty sure you have, right?
Yes.
Okay. So the there were two big points that I think are a problem for me, and where either Zack Snyder didn't understand what the point of the graphic novel was, or didn't care and just was putting it to the screen. In the graphic novel, the superheroes in the graphic novel are pretty crappy, shitty people, pathetic. Mm-hmm. They're impotent, sexist, racist, homophobic, they rape people, you know, they're not good people. And with some of the heroes in this movie, they completely like gloss over that fact and just like try and make them look really cool. Like Night Owl, for instance. Night Owl is really cool. I loved him in this movie, but he's different than the Night Owl in the graphic novel. Rorschach is the biggest one though. Rorschach, like every shot where he's like wearing the mask and everything is designed to be like make him look awesome. Even the way he like reads the journal is made to make him look cool. But in the comic books, he's like stinky. He's, you know, just a shitty guy in general. He's not someone you would admire at all. He's obviously like completely insane beyond Batman. He's like psychopathic, not just sociopathic. Like, he has so many problems, and they don't really touch on that at all. You know, they have the rape scene with the comedian, which is a really important scene in the movie and in the graphic novel. But, you know, in a lot of the ways he's filmed, he's still filmed in a way that's like made to make him look cool. You know, like when he's going and killing civilians, when he drops out of Archimedes and is like shotgunning people and blasting. He does like the 3-point cool superhero landing, and which Night Owls is actually way cooler, if you ask me. But
well, he's got the cape, you know.
Yeah, it looks awesome. Even watching it now, I was like, whoa, that's so cool. But it's, which Zack Snyder's great at. We've covered that a million times on the show. But yeah, the comedian was filmed in a way that was like made to make him look cool too. And I think in the graphic novel, there wasn't really supposed to be like mixed feelings about these heroes. Like, they were just shitty, like pathetic people in general. Whereas in this, it's kind of mixed feelings, right? I mean, so I don't know. That's my first big point. What do you guys think about that?
So I agree with you. I do. My only thought is, I don't know necessarily if it was Snyder not caring as much as it might have been from a marketing standpoint, a way to try and do this successfully, because it is difficult to have a film where there are no good guys. Right? It's just hard to do. Because even like when they did Deadpool, you know, Deadpool's, he's an anti-hero. He does bad stuff, but pretty much only to bad people. So he's still kind of a good guy. Having your only people, all of your protagonists, all be absolute trash, I just think is a difficult thing to have people watch. So that's where I would put like my money on why. But I agree with you. They're all, other than the comedian, right, they're all painted as at least more good than bad, right? Even though, you know, obviously there's bad to most of them, they're, the good kind of is pushed to outweigh that, so they can still be redeemable.
My only response to that would be that that's one of the major points of the graphic novel. So glossing over that to appeal to audiences is a tough thing for me. You know, yeah,
I agree with you. I'm not saying it was the right thing to do. I just think that was the line of thought.
Yeah, it was just to make it more palatable for the general audience, I'm sure. What about you, Rachel? Do you agree?
So I'm not sure I do, and not for the reason that you think. I think it might be because of my female perspective, that these people, not even in 2009, like, their costumes came off as cool, but I never thought they were good people. And I think maybe, you know, Snyder tried to make them a little bit more heroic, but even now, none of them come off as appealing. I don't want to know these people in real life. I don't want to meet them in the streets. Like, I'm wondering if it's because, you know, Comedian and Rorschach were not marketed to my demographic as being cool. Because honestly, I just see these guys and they have zero appeal to me. So I don't know. What do you guys
maybe think? It's because of the male power fantasy or like whatever. I don't know. But I mean, Rorschach and Comedian, they looked pretty cool in this movie a lot of the time. I mean, like I said, it could just be that I'm a male or that I was raised differently or something. I don't really know what the difference is, but Comedian for sure, like in a couple of the scenes, he looked pretty cool. They were like trying to make him look like an 80s action hero in like the Vietnam scenes, and like you know, what he was doing was clearly not cool, but you know, I don't know, it was framed as heroic a lot of it. Maybe not when he shoots
he murdered a woman he impregnated, and
he's a piece of shit. Like, they
like, he was shooting tear gas out of a shotgun at point blank range into protesters. So, like, at no point did I think this guy was a good guy.
But was he shooting? I don't think he was shooting. When I was watching it this time, I don't think he was shooting. He shot tear gas, like, at the end when he, like, shot that guy that was over.
Yeah, that's all I was.
But he drops out with an actual shotgun.
Right. He's shooting at real people, and like the way that scene even kicks off, the first person he attacks is just like a woman off to the side.
Yeah, he punches her in the face or something like that. Right?
When like they're not even touching him or anything like that. So like at least for me, the comedian is a bad guy basically the entire film. I'm not even sure, other than like literally the first shot of him, you know, for the photograph. Like other than that, you know, he's just a bad guy.
Or when he humanizes a little bit and goes and talks to his old villain.
I mean, he's clearly messed up. And like, it's not that I don't have like any sympathy for a broken mind, right? He clearly needs help. But for me, he's a bad guy the entire time. Manhattan is kind of painted in a negative light the entire time as well. I think Night Owl and Silk Spectre, on the other hand, they're like the good guys in the movie, right? Because Rorschach is basically like completely unhinged Batman, just with no money.
Or Punisher,
right? Yeah, Punisher's probably a better example, just without the guns. Whereas I think Silk Spectre and Night Owl, or Night Owl 2, however you want to frame it or whatever, both of them are twos, I guess. They're like the only real heroes, because they don't really do anything bad in
the
movie.
They're also retired. They're the only ones that really like stepped out of the work.
That's fair. That's also fair. Because like you only see them hurt people who've like directly attacked them, or you know, are the main villain at the end of the movie.
And they do the only good act. They stop a fire, or they rescue people from a fire. But to me, they're also the complacent ones. You know, they join the mission. In my opinion, they're the most flashy, well, aside from Ozzy. But they seem like they were in it for some publicity or fame or something. Maybe a little bit.
I never got that.
That's fair.
Well, Silk Spectre more came across to me as like she's doing it because that's what her mom did, and like she what felt pressured to be what her mom was. Night
and
Owl,
that was
definitely
the image in the comic, but like, what's the point of Night Owl using his money for a self-indulgent owl ship?
Well, I mean, it was useful to the team, but yeah, I mean, I get it. His intentions are a little weird, but like that scene where we keep talking about with comedian. Night Owl is there, and he's not stopping comedian. He's like comedian is talking about how we just gotta have fun because the masks are getting outlawed, and he's shooting people right in front of Night Owl, and Night Owl does nothing to stop him.
Well, because Night
he's, like,
Owl
kind of regretful about it, right? He comments like, "What have we become?" or whatever. What's happened to us? But nothing is shown that to where like he tries to stop him or does anything like
exactly.
that.
Because like integrity wise, he kind of comes off a bit like a coward. Like he wants to be the hero, right? He wants to do the right thing, but not if it really is going to put him at risk. And the reality is that one-on-one, comedian's going to kick his ass.
Probably,
right?
Yeah.
You know, like I feel like that's how that would go, especially because comedian's going to fight dirty and he's got guns on him and all that other stuff. So like, Night Owl doesn't do the right thing in that scene, and I think it's just because he's scared of comedian.
Night Owl is a coward, and they address, I think like they fully flesh this stuff out a bit better in the comics for absolutely. Sure, because you know, you use the line impotent, and in the comics he actually says that in the scene where he's staring at the suit and he's naked, he says the word impotent, and you know, ha ha ha, we're supposed to think it's just his dick and he can't have sex with Lori. But that's not all he means. Like his entire life he has just been this kind of broken person. He's not just impotent in the bedroom, he's just an impotent person. He can't do his job, he can't step up and finish things. So
but some of that is kind of lost in this movie. It seems
it
like
absolutely is.
He's just like, now he goes and saves those people from the fire so that he can get a hard on and have sex with Lori, you know.
I don't know if that's why he did it, but
I mean,
it definitely seems like that's all it took.
Yeah,
it definitely came off that they just needed a little bit of, you know, self pride,
right? Like he needed to indulge himself a little bit,
right?
Which, It's very like, selfish.
He got the boner not from Lori, but because he helped did. People. Yeah, he had that rush of adrenaline. Because immediately after, they're like, "Man, it'd be a lot of fun to go break into a prison."
Right.
Like they actually say that. So.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. No. That's
they didn't get their jollies off. Like they're not great people either.
No,
they're just the best of the group is all.
Which is not saying much. Yeah. But yeah, like Rorschach in the graphic novel, like he's not great in this, but he's at least, I don't know, he's at least cool in this, right? Like for me anyway, he came across as cool, and I'm sure he did for you, Derek, too, because you did a costume of him. So obviously there was some appeal, but you know, in the graphic novel, he was just a crazy piece of shit. Like there was nothing redeemable about him.
No, because in the movie, he's completely carnal. It's very id focus. It's all visceral for him. But in the movie, it's all framed as a twisted form of justice. He's only going after a certain type of people, and he's not even killing everybody because of, you know, the line when he is about, you know, when he goes to kill the guy who killed the girl. You know, he mentions about how, you know, men go to prison.
Dogs get put down,
right? So even like as unhinged as he is, he also knows what's going on. Like the scene with the psychiatrist and the ink blots, right? He knows he's crazy. He knows what he's seeing, and he knows if he says it, he's going to get put in a padded room and he'll never escape. So he knows enough. He's aware enough to avoid that. And I think for me, what keeps him at least on the side of I'm able to follow him, right, and know that he's at least like doing what he thinks he can do, is because he's only trying to go after the bad people, right? If you're a good person, he's not gonna mess with you at all, right? But if you're gonna rob a bank, if you're gonna kill a kid, he's gonna come for you with everything that he's got. And it's like, that's why I kind of said like the unhinged Batman just with no money, right? Because it kind of felt like what we saw in BVS, that version of Batman, right? Except with all of his, you know, fancy toys.
I'll just say it now because we kind of just talked about it. I didn't like it in 2009. I didn't like it in the graphic novel, and I don't like it now when he kills the dogs.
Nope.
The dogs didn't do shit. Like they were chewing on a girl's leg, which isn't great, but that was not their fault. I mean, they're just dogs, you know. They don't know any different. So yeah. I know he did it as like a message, but then he killed the guy right after. So the dogs seem like they were needlessly, you know, I don't know. They were just innocent victims in this whole thing.
It was that, and when he gets back at his bully and he starts to fight him as a kid, young Rorschach, and he bites them, like he rips part of the cheek off, that's the two main things that really solidifies that Rorschach has never been a hero, that he's not interested in achieving justice, that he's interested in retribution and punishment in putting someone completely down, because there's something very carnal about a bite like that. You know, you do that biting in fights is usually used as one of two ways. You know, the first one's self-defense when it's like the last thing you really have, because there's always that risk you could lose teeth. But then, you know, you take away somebody's cheek, you know, you do the Mike Tyson, Evander Holyfield ear biting thing, like you remove a person's body part, you're sending a message. You want them to know that you are the most powerful and not to mess with you ever again. And so like Rorschach to me never came off as the hero. He just always seemed like, you push me far enough and I'm going to be the bigger bully. You know, he could have easily put that prisoner down without killing him, but instead he throws hot oil on this guy's face.
One of my favorite scenes, honestly. Slowly.
Yeah,
you're right. You're absolutely right.
So like, I'm just saying, in my opinion, he was never cool.
For me, he was cool in the Hot Topic sense, you know, like Joker is cool, right? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, what he's doing is not cool. But
well, that I understand. I can totally get behind that. I think the difference is Joker has yet to be our protagonist. Except in his own movie. Yeah, sorry, man.
Real quick,
you pushed it out of your mind too, so I understand.
Real quick fun fact, the young Rorschach is actually played by Eli Snyder, one of Zack Snyder's kids.
That nice. Is really
did a
cool.
Good job.
So a little role there.
But yeah, to your point about the biting, Rachel, it is really interesting in like action and fight scenes. They almost always avoid biting in movies because in general in society, it's kind of a dirty tactic, right? It's considered a dirty tactic. Like if I get in a bar fight with somebody, I'm probably not going to bite them, right. You know? But in movies, yeah, the only time you really see it in movies, you don't even see it in the circumstance that you mentioned with like, it's the last resort because
no,
you
that's know, more movies. Of a real life thing.
That's a real life thing.
Like,
yeah.
Attacked or something. Like,
in movies, yeah. It's literally just to show that this person is completely unhinged. Mm-hmm. And maybe, you know, so you're listening now and you know a movie where they show that as like a last resort type thing. Hit me on Twitter because I'm interested to see that. But
same here.
Yeah, it's almost always just to show how crazy the person is in movies.
Well, Rorschach also gets a bit of pleasure out of that retribution. He wants that revenge. He wants to see that person get his version of justice. You know, it's why he, when the guy's being electrocuted on the floor of his cell, he's kind of like watching the whole time. Like he's fine with it. It makes him almost happy that the person got what he thinks he deserved.
And he totally acknowledges that it's fucked up. He says that Walter Kovacs died and that since then there's only Rorschach. He knows he's messed up. He just doesn't want to rehabilitate anymore. He doesn't want to address the trauma and be a better person. He wants to stop everybody that's worse than him.
Yeah, pretty much. Because his perspective is supposed to be that the world is not savable. Right. And that's kind of the whole premise of the movie, right, is that the human race is damned to destroy itself. And that's kind of the boat that he's in. He agrees with that. And he agrees that the cops aren't going to do it and the politicians aren't going to do it. And so if no one else is going to do it, then fine, he'll go ahead and fucking do it. Right. And that doesn't make him a hero. But in his head, he thinks it's the only answer.
Mm-hmm. So. I'll get to my other point in a little bit. My other point that I didn't agree with, the change I didn't like, because I said there were two. But this movie, one thing I love about this movie and that it does very well are the action scenes. Mm-hmm. Particularly the alley scene with Silk Spectre and Night Owl, but more so for me, the jail scene. Not just the fight scene, but all basically everything with Rorschach leading up to that also is just wonderful for me. I loved that alley scene. I kind of would have liked to have seen it all as one solid scene instead of like interspersed with other scenes. Mm-hmm. And maybe I thought I remembered that it was one solid scene, so maybe that's the director's cut was that way.
It is extended.
I believe so. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, it's one of the scenes that gets cut down.
I think it's a little gratuitous in terms of like the bones coming out of people's arms and stuff, but I mean it's that gives it a little depth and more realism, and I appreciate that in a fight scene.
It does fit Watchmen, because to me, like watching this movie again, different things have hit since I last really watched it.
Yeah, the world is different now for you personally and on a larger scale.
Exactly. So certain things hit a little bit differently, harder, things like that. So I found it a little hard to watch in some spots when, you know, the bones were flying and people were exploding. It didn't just feel like, you know, the disconnect in movies where you can totally forget about that all these humans just exploded. But at the same time, I felt it worked within the context so well. That this movie is,
it's certainly not fun to watch bones come out of people's bodies. No, I mean, it's
visually stunning. Like, all the costumes are amazing, most of the fight scenes are great. One of my favorite fight scenes is actually not even in this cut that we watched. It's Night Owl One taking on the Knot Tops in house.
I love Night Owl One so much.
Hollis is great, like, and I don't know if you guys ever read the companion book, the Under the Mask by Hollis Mason that they actually put out, but that's a lot of fun too. And I really enjoyed that
He was a great character. Like, you know, when I went and saw this in theaters, I was really disappointed that they cut out the whole scene where those guys go in to beat the shit out of him. Because that was an important scene, right? They give us old Night Owl, or original Night Owl, and he's cool. We're like him. He does like the jokey upper jab that knocked out that, you know, whatever villain. And he's appealing to the audience, right? And then you never really find out what's going on with him, you know? But in the graphic novel, they do address that. And I remember when I saw the theatrical cut, I was super disappointed that that was not a part of it. Because that was, I liked that scene a lot in the graphic novel. It really added a lot to it for me.
Well, so, I think we joke a lot about the nostalgia aspect that people have. You know, there's a lot of jokes about grandparents going like, back in my day, blah, blah, blah. When Hollis Mason and Sally Jupiter are the absolute like pinnacle of that. They love to wax nostalgic about things,
and they were when they were fighting, they weren't doing it in big thick rubber armor, right? Like they weren't doing it, I'm assuming the new Silk Spectre doesn't really have armor either, but you know, the new Night Owl is wearing like full body armor, or at least it's implied that that's what that is. So you know, this other guy was doing it in short shorts.
Yeah, he's maybe wearing one of those old leather football helmets
at best.
Yeah, like that's the best that they got. I think my biggest part about why I dislike Watchmen as a whole, both the comic book, both the movie, is because the Minutemen is way more exciting for me. Like, I want to see the whole dollar bill fight where he gets his cape caught. I want to see Mothman decline. I want to see Hooded Justice and Sally Jupiter go through that fake relationship that they have, and but yeah, also the world cool. after Watchmen is also interesting. So the fact that like the comic book focuses more on the six characters from the 80s, and then the sequel comic books focus on the comic books that still deal with these characters, just go back to like the 70s to before Watchmen, is just not as interesting as the other stuff going around. So
you know, when they announced the show, I was really hoping that it was going to be those characters, since we haven't really got anything from them. But yeah, I'm sure the show is great, kinda. I haven't watched it, but
yeah, you know. Jeremy Irons plays an older version of Matthew Good's character, and that's basically it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So kind of talking about, you know, we were talking about the fight scenes and how kind of it looks. And I would argue that this is still the best looking Zack Snyder movie, from just the visuals, the special effects, the fight choreography, the cinematography in general, the way it's shot, the way it's lit. Story aside, it's still a gorgeous movie. And it's, you know, 12 years old now. And it still looks really, really good today. I think all of the special effects held up. I didn't really see anything that looked funky to me, at least not in the theatrical cut. It's been a while since I've watched the director's cut or the ultimate cut. But I mean, the costumes are all still top notch. And I think that it's very interesting that the movie still looks as good as it does. When you think about what was being made at the time, like this was, you know, a year after Iron Man, right? This was, you know, The Dark Knight and things like that. And I think this was a more visually ambitious project than either of those. And it still holds up.
I'm going to disagree on part of that. I agree that with almost everything you said, but I don't think it's Zack Snyder's most visually stunning movie. I think that for me, that honor goes to 300. Not only because it's of everything that it did, but it also did it 3 years before this movie.
Yeah, I just think some of the stuff in 300, a lot of the background green screen work doesn't hold up as well as you might remember.
I just watched it like a year ago and I was still impressed by it. So I don't know.
Sounds like we need to do a review of 300.
I'm great with that. I love that movie. So yeah, I would absolutely do that.
I will take 300 men in Speedos over one giant blue dong.
So are you saying that you prefer
I'm saying
in terms of this, or in terms with Derek, just apart from the dongs and the pitmen and thongs. In terms
I'm
of
saying that if we color. Actually do that, I'm gonna be so horny on the podcast.
That's fine, but like, can you just agree with one of us right now, please? I need to know if I'm beating Derek or if Derek's winning. You're married to him though, so I already know which way it goes. You can't have your own opinions because you're married to him.
I have to go to bed with him later.
Like, exactly. No, fine. Look,
I don't mean any real knock against 300. I love 300. It was actually the first Blu-ray I ever purchased was 300. My so like, God, I don't do mean you... any insult to that. I just think that 300 is stylistically done to kind of look almost comic booky. Whereas this looks like hyper realistic, right? It all looks very real. There's a ton of practical work involved in it. And between the costuming and the fight scenes and the visuals, I just think it still looks outstanding. When a lot of movies, you know, from that time weren't even this ambitious and have some CGI stuff that doesn't hold up anymore. So I was just really impressed with it.
So in regards to the costuming, I agree with you. Almost 100%.
Which Ozymandias, have a problem with.
Ozymandias' costume, like, it looks really good when he's standing still and, like, delivering a monologue. But then as soon as he starts moving, you can see, like, the little flaps on the back of his neck. Neck seal is what we call in the costuming world. But that thing, like, start flapping up in the back and, like, it makes it look like it's not actually armor. Like it's a piece of, it's probably foam latex in real life, but
yeah,
you know, something like that. It doesn't move like a piece of armor would. And watching it now, I picked up on that. I didn't before. And that's probably just my like costume eyes looking at stuff. But other than that, yeah, dude, it's Night Owl snowsuit in the graphic novel was like, I loved it so much. And they did such a cool translation of it in this movie. I would do that. I would do either of his costumes in this movie at any point if given the ability to like have unlimited money and unlimited time to make it, because I love them so much.
Well, because I mean, Night Owl's from a costume perspective is just so similar to Batman. It's a very big commitment.
It's well executed to a lot better than some of the Batmans though. Like it's just more intricate than a lot of the on-screen Batmans we've seen, honestly.
Well, yeah. I mean, especially back then. I mean, you know, this was the Christian Bale Batman, which I know his costume was very kind of divisive among people. And I still think Night Owl looks spectacular.
He does. And only when he keeps his goggles on, though. When he takes his goggles off, it bothers me that he's not wearing like eye brown. Like, Batman wears the eye black around his eyes. But every time he took it off, it looked like a cosplayer that forgot to put on their eye black when they're wearing a Batman cowl. And that bothered me a lot more now.
It's such a weird thing, though, because also it's kind of like, you know, anytime Batman would take the cowl off, magically that eye stuff was gone.
Right.
You know,
right. And that bothers me, too. But, you know, we're talking about this movie. So, yeah, I mean, in this movie, that bothered me more than it should. It's not really a knock on the movie because I wouldn't put eye black on either if I was going out and wearing goggles and there's no point.
Right.
But, you know, whatever. That's a little nitpick. Okay, so my second thing, and this is probably pretty, this is an important thing to talk about anyway, and you guys can probably guess where I'm gonna hit the ending. It was very divisive when it came out.
Yeah.
And when it came out, I actually was okay with this change, the big ending change, but now rewatching it, I think that it was not what the film really needed. It kind of felt like Zack Snyder missing the point again. So if you don't know what I'm talking about, in the movie, Ozymandias sets up this thing to make it look like Dr. Manhattan blew up New York or whatever city. I assume it's New York.
It's 13 different cities. So New York's one of them. I think it's okay. New York, Chicago, and LA here, and then like all over the globe.
Yes. So he does that to make it look like Manhattan, you know, did all this. Mm-hmm. In the comics, it's basically, I don't remember if it's one giant squid or if it's multiple. I thought it was just one. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, it's one.
That spawns up somewhere in the United States and it's like a giant alien squid and starts attacking.
Yeah, instead of a nuclear holocaust, he mimics an alien invasion. And he had been hosting this alien and on an island and he had been kidnapping people. Instead of getting cancer, they were being abducted. And so that's what happened.
I mean, I think that may have been a little too comic booky for what they were doing. Number one, I don't know if it could be taken as seriously. And number two, from a cost perspective, making that look as good as the rest of the movie may not have been an option.
I'm not discounting either of those things, but in the context of what the original graphic novel was trying to do, I don't think that this version, the thing that was in the graphic novel, it was meant to be a neutral threat that the entire world could rally around and fight against.
Right.
In this movie, it was not a neutral threat because it's made clear several times that that America has a Superman, or that there's a Superman and he's American or whatever. So him going and attacking all these other countries, I mean, is that really going to unite all the countries against Dr. Manhattan? Dr. Manhattan is an American, and sure, American cities got hit too. But I mean, for me, the neutral threat of the squid, of the alien attack, they could have found some way to mimic that without needing the CGI. You know, there's something they could do rather than turning.
It could have been different aliens. It could have been, yeah,
something that would
have to be a squid. I mean, I agree with that. My biggest problem with it isn't so much that it's Dr. Manhattan as much as like it's still temporary, right? Because at some point, if Dr. Manhattan doesn't show up in 5 years or 20 years or 50 years, eventually somebody somewhere is going to think he's gone, right?
It's true.
Then start building a military backup, and then someone else can be like, well, what if they're right and they're going to start building a military backup? It doesn't actually solve any problem. It just pauses everything for a while. And that's my biggest problem with the solution, is that it's just a stopgap. It doesn't solve any problem.
And why would the Soviets come out to help an imperialistic United States that destroyed one of its own cities because it lost control of a nuke? You know what I mean? Like, I don't know. You're right. It is a temporary solution, but even in the beginning, it's like, it doesn't make any sense to me that now all of a sudden the Soviets are okay with helping America. Mm-hmm. You know, because one of their nukes essentially went off across the world.
And it also just, there's never really, the motivation is never really put in there. Like, okay, so the cancer thing doesn't really do anything because that has nothing to do with the resolution of the movie. If you remove the cancer piece completely, the ending doesn't change. And so you just have Dr. Manhattan go from this maybe neutral scientist, maybe American scientist, to just complete genocidal maniac alien who disappears. There's no build up to that.
Well, the cancer thing was supposed to, as I understood it, do two things. One, it was supposed to make Dr. Manhattan go, huh, what's going on? And then leave to Mars because he's like contemplating whether he gave these people cancer. But then also they did that on live TV. So it's meant to have people go, okay, well, this guy's giving people cancer. And then he like screamed and went to Mars. So maybe he did go crazy. I think this was what the payoff was for that. I'm not saying it was great or the right way to do it, but I think that's where they were headed with it.
Ray, what do you think?
So I definitely think the giant squid I found silly in the comics, so I'm glad they changed it. Ozymandias turning it against the very guy he was trying, like using to help deter nuclear war, is pretty fucking calculating. And to me, it makes him a better villain than what he was in the comics. But I do agree. And Dan, or Night Owl, says that at the very end, that like, as long as people think that Manhattan's out there watching us, everybody will, you know, stay in line. But until then, or once that's over, it's over. But that's just how things go anyway. That's just a deterrent. Like, anytime there's a peace, it's just as, I guess, it's going to end. Just like war is going to end. Nothing goes on forever.
And I agree with that. The difference here is the whole thing is is like leaning on the premise that it was okay to kill these tens of millions of people because we're going to save these billions of people.
Oh, because, I never like that. Yeah. I hate the whole like
kill millions to save billions.
Yeah, I have always hated that. You have to sacrifice this so that these people, I hate the trolley problem. Like it's not a choice that you should ever have to make.
It's not like it's the ends justify the means argument, right?
And, but yeah,
the problem is that for me, since it doesn't actually solve the problem, then it's an irrelevant talking point because it's just
the means.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Or the means delay the ends. Yeah.
Right. So like the end is still coming. And actually by then the population would theoretically be higher. So you're actually putting even more people at risk of being killed.
Which right? is why the best thing that Rorschach does is submit his journal to that newspaper at the end.
Mm-hmm.
Which will right. likely not be taken seriously, though.
And I mean, can I just say, like, how shitty of a point of view is it when, like, the world is finally having some peace and you can't find one goddamn story to write about? Like, you're just shitty at your job. Go somewhere else, old guy.
It's a bad kind of tack on at the end because, yeah, like, okay, so if the journal gets published, there's only one of two outcomes. People think it's ridiculous, right?
Or the conspiracy theorists latch onto it. And,
right.
You know.
Or people take it seriously and then the piece is over anyway. So like it kind of hinges on that. So the whole thing could be for naught because of this journal, or it's irrelevant. So don't show the scene. those are the two options.
Did you guys feel to me that the tiger was a bit of a waste?
Bubastis?
Yeah.
Yeah, he was way cooler in the graphic novel. But even in the graphic novel, he didn't really do much.
No,
it was more be his evil hench or show how evil he was or whatever.
Well, and it's just to show like how much money and power Ozzy has. Right. Like, think of people off the top of your head that have tigers.
Mike Tyson.
Exactly. And, you know, even in comic books and stuff, like in The Walking Dead. That guy has a tiger.
Ezekiel, yeah.
Yeah, Ezekiel has a tiger.
It's a little different with him because he's like...
It's always for a power trip of some kind. Like, sure. For some characters, it works, but, like, it's always a power trip to show that you have an exotic animal.
I think it would have come off better if it was just a regular tiger. Because it looks like an alien creature. And so, like, for a lot of people, it just doesn't even make sense that it's there.
Right, yeah, when I was watching it now, I was like, man, can I even imagine what it's like for just a random person that has no idea what the graphic novel is to go in and see this movie? All of a sudden, 2.5 hours in, there's a fucking, like, antenna-clad tiger.
And then, like, four minutes later, he kills him.
He's dead, yeah, it's like, okay, well, I guess his name is Bubastis because he says it once, but, you know, yeah, you have no idea. The other thing that Rachel and I agree on, I know we've talked about this before that we didn't like about this movie, was the casting of Ozymandias. Because the actor is fine, but you can instantly tell he's a villain. It's in the graphic novel, it's a surprise when it turns out that it was Ozymandias the whole time.
And it really bothers me because it's not even the casting, it's how Matthew Good plays him. I've watched movies with Matthew Good and he smiles and he's nice and he's cheerful. He's not this like brooding,
pretentious like
guy. Yeah,
see, I don't know, part of me thinks that maybe because we know, we're reading more into it. Watching it this time, I really tried to push all of that aside, and I think he doesn't seem any more like a villain than any of the other Watchmen do.
Nah, he monologues too much.
Yeah, he monologues and he like just acts how or shows off how smart he is all the time.
Well, but that's the thing though. Like they're all kind of assholes. It's just his asshole thing is to be hyper intelligent.
Now, anybody who says the only person I've ever connected with is Alexander the Great.
Right, like come on.
Like fuck no, he's off, dude.
He's a pretentious asshole, but they're all assholes.
Pretentious is like, I only eat at this restaurant. And no, this guy, I only have connected with one person. And
in the entire history
of the world. No, and he was like a ruthless conqueror too. Like, no. Absolutely.
I'm not disagreeing with that. I'm just saying that when you put him on the shelf with the other five characters, he still doesn't come off as the most evil one of those six.
No, but he comes across as the one most capable of hatching a plan to do something ridiculous. You know,
he
what I mean?
Commits genocide.
Yeah.
Like,
no. By the end of the film, but you're talking about in the beginning when you don't know he's the bad guy, right? Before you know he's the bad guy, if you were to put him on a scale with everybody, he's kind of more in the middle. I mean, Rorschach and the comedian are definitely more evil throughout the film than he is, and then you throw Manhattan in there, who could
dead
just
already. So I mean, we know it's not him.
Well, I do believe he is the ultimate fuckboy, and the minute comedian told him his plan to save the world wasn't going to work, that's when he started hatching this plan.
He's like, I'm gonna murder this guy.
He's like, this is it, I'm doing this.
Fuck this dude, he just lit my map on fire,
right,
with a cigar or whatever. I mean, come on. No, I mean, for me, it still didn't really work. Even trying to like take it all in as a fresh breath of air, it still came across like he was just this elitist asshole and yes, they're all bad, but he was never portrayed really as being cool, whereas the other ones were. So, I mean, watching it this time, in the scene where he's like, they have to show how gay he is, meeting up with like a bunch of drag queens and like 80s hair band people. There was like David Bowie in the back. Did you guys see that?
No, I missed that.
Yeah, yeah. I was like, is that supposed to be David Bowie? And the face makeup was like, not Ziggy Star. It was
Aladdin Sane.
Yeah, there was a guy that had very similar, and they were clearly going for like, he's hanging out with Bowie. But they couldn't like use Bowie's exact likeness.
Right. Well, I missed that. That's funny.
I mean, they did that throughout that whole montage. Like, they had people impersonating Andy Warhol, and, yeah, you know, Richard Nixon was in there, and then Stalin was in there.
So I had just never noticed the David Bowie guy in the background leaning on a car. I thought that was funny.
But yeah, like, he was at Studio 54, so that was, you know, drugs and sex mecca in the 70s and 80s. So
I also think they were a little heavy-handed. Maybe I'm just reading too much into it with the gay stuff with him. Like, it's not that important to us. It's cool that there's a gay character in a comic book, right? Don't get me wrong, but they like in the movie really like, you know, he has that one scene, but then like when they're on his folder, he has a folder that says boys. Like, I mean, is it really that important that we know he's gay? Like, is that?
I never picked up that Ozzy's gay, like, ever.
Really?
Yeah. But I mean,
possibly homosexual when Rorschach like is monologuing about him in his journal or whatever.
Well, yeah.
Must investigate. He says in the comic, he says like possibly homosexual. Must investigate further. He didn't say that. Did he say that in this cut? I don't think he did.
I don't know, but like, there was the whole Hooded Justice was probably gay, and Silk Spectre was his beard, and then of course Silhouette is an out lesbian with the nurse. So
those are all important to their characters, right?
Well, I mean, it's not really important. Problem is, I think Alan Moore was trying to be LGBT friendly, and he was trying to show representation in times when it was kind of dismissed. But the problem is, for all three of them, it doesn't come off as a good thing. It comes like the boys thing seems like Ozymandias.
That was only in the movie, though. I'm complaining more about the way it was handled in the movie, not the way Alan Moore handled it necessarily. Having a folder that said boys on the computer is totally unnecessary. Didn't
at the
add
same
anything.
Time, like, he created these characters, and
he did.
So, I don't think it's ever portrayed as a good thing. I think, you know, Silhouette is obviously murdered. She's punished for being gay.
Yeah, lesbian whores or whatever, yeah. They write on the wall. It's pretty fucked up.
So I don't think being gay is, A, important to Ozymandias, but also B, a positive thing, which is horrible.
Right, which is why do they have to make such a point that he's gay? Like, it's fine if it just, like, naturally is a part of whatever's happening, right? Like, I don't even mind the scene where, you know, at Studio 54, you know, I don't mind that at all. It was a part, it's just showing like his past or whatever, but this, the folder marked boys was just like a super heavy handed thing that didn't actually add anything. It just kind of vilified him. Yeah. So
I think the Studio 54 thing is just to show how different everybody is, that, you know, Ozymandias is a celebrity first.
Sure.
He's the public face of the Watchmen. He is the, he's not in it to save the world. Like, we don't ever actually see him do anything good
until the end. Like, you don't even see him doing anything super. I guess you kind of see it when like the fake murder assassination thing happens, but I mean, really, even then you just see him like duck around a little bit and whack a guy with a pole.
I don't see him be a hero,
right? Definitely not.
And I know that they comment very heavily on how he hired the fake assassin, but he also strategically had it so that the people that were just disagreeing with him were murdered.
Yeah.
And they do overlook that. Like, you know, well, let's not talk about that guy who attempted to kill you. Let's talk about like the six people he did kill.
Yeah, that you hid behind.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he literally moves behind one of them as a shield.
So
comment on that?
Yeah.
Come on. It was a lot. Yeah, I just don't really like the way they handle Ozymandias. Is I guess the way
That's fine. So we are nearing like our hour mark here. What are some other areas that you would like to touch on?
I don't know. I've hit a lot of my heavy.
Yeah, I asked the questions that I wanted to. I wanted to go a little bit deeper.
Well, I just want to touch on the soundtrack for a minute. I think the soundtrack is pretty fantastic in this movie. I think it's kind of underrated or overlooked when we talk about movie soundtracks. So if you haven't heard it in a while, it's on Spotify, so I definitely recommend you check
it out. It's never overlooked for me. I've had some of those songs since this movie came out on my Spotify playlist, and even the one that was in the trailer that wasn't actually in the, I don't think it was actually in the movie, the one that was like Smashing the end Pumpkins. Is the beginning is the end, yeah, or what, yeah. Is that what it's called, something like that? Yeah, it was only in the trailers, right? It would never actually made it to the movie.
Correct. So the song is, it's the Smashing Pumpkins, it's the beginning is the end is the beginning, which fun little fact is the B-side of the beginning is the end is the beginning, which is in Batman Forever. It's on the Batman Forever soundtrack.
I noticed that when we reviewed Batman Forever not too long ago. Maybe it was like a year ago. It's been a while.
So that trailer, so regardless of my feelings on the film itself, I still think that trailer is one of the best movie trailers I've personally seen, and the song is a huge part of that. Yeah. And it kind of got me interested in Smashing Pumpkins. I kind of once in a while listened to them, but I like definitely went and purposely checked them out because I liked the song so much.
But yeah, even the rest of the soundtrack, there's not a miss on it, honestly. It's a little weird with what we know now about Hallelujah.
Yeah.
That that's what they're playing when they're having sex. Go ahead.
I was going to say, what we're referring to is, so the reason Hallelujah has been so much a big part of the Snyder Cut and is in a lot of Zack Snyder's stuff, at least in trailer form, is because the song is or was his daughter's favorite, the daughter who committed suicide back in 2017. So that's her favorite song.
But she was a child when Watchmen came out. So yes, he could have just played that in the movie, and then that was like her first exposure to it or something.
It's just weird that it was during the sex scene for me. Like,
a little bit.
You know?
But I don't think that's her fault.
Yeah,
well, that's not her fault. I'm not saying that at all.
We don't really know when she first heard it or why it was her favorite or anything like that. We now know that is the reason it's such a big part of the Snyder Cut. It's very intentional because of everything that's gone on with that. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago, so you can check that out. I'm sure we'll talk about that stuff in the future. But yeah,
I want to point out that Zack Snyder's use of music in all of his films is very purposeful. He has a keen ear for music, and he wants, when a song plays, he wants you to notice the song. It is not supposed to blend in. It is not supposed to be forgotten. You're supposed to recall this scene with the entire scope of it, including the music. You know, that montage with A Change Is Coming, or what's the Bob Dylan song? These times are changing.
Yeah.
That's very purposeful. The Sound of Silence playing at the funeral, like, they're synonymous. You think of that scene and you hear his songs. Now, whether you like it or not, you know, a lot of people say that that sex scene is super awkward and that song doesn't fit. You still remember the two together. So,
sure.
You know, like, in the end, he's kind of done his job with that.
On a similar note, I do agree with you, but I also think that sometimes his song choice can be a little heavy-handed.
It is very distracting at times, too.
Yeah, like, sometimes it's a little too on the nose. He's like, he's trying to be clever by picking the song for this scene, but then really it's more like, okay, I mean, it just comes across as heavy-handed and maybe not the best for the scene. So.
Well, I think there are some directors out there that get a lot of praise for their soundtrack choices, like Tarantino. And, you know, I think it's overhyped.
For sure.
Like Tarantino. And then I feel like there are some that have very good and nuanced picks for soundtracks that never really get praised. Like Zach Braff directs like kind of movies that nobody really talks about anymore. Garden State's really the only one that stands out, but his soundtracks are always top notch. And then there is Zack Snyder, who is a divisive director altogether. You either love him or you hate him, and there's not a lot in between, but the soundtracks fall in there too. Some of the songs are wonderful, like the montage at the beginning, and some of the song choices are really awkward, like the Hallelujah sex scene. So it's just...
I never found that scene awkward.
It's
I don't
never
know.
That version of that song to that act is so weird, which is weird for me because even from the beginning, the first time I heard that song, I was like, that is not about religion.
Yeah,
I never found it that scene weird. I don't know. I've heard lots of people. So obviously I'm the odd man out on this. And I know that I don't understand why it's weird.
Because you were looking at Malin Ackerman's tits the whole time.
Probably. But the song choice and like being awkward or heavy-handed, that is just a Zack Snyder trait because he does that with his writing a lot too. Mm-hmm. Or like the way he does things could be considered heavy-handed, and I understand why people complain about that a lot from him. Some of the time it bothers me, some of the time it doesn't. It only bothers me when I feel like he thinks he's being clever with it and he's not. And I'm worried we're going to get a lot of that in the Snyder cut, but we'll see. It was funny because going through this movie and watching it with my girlfriend, I was like, I bet you there's a shot like that in Snyder cut. And I bet you there's a shot like that in Snyder cut. There's just some scenes that he does in like every movie, you know, like the cemetery scene with like the slow pan out. You know, in this movie it was to the Sound of Silence, but like you slowly go through the gate and it gets wider and you see the gate of the cemetery and everything. You know, I would probably be willing to bet that there's a scene like that in Justice League.
He has a style, you know, he really does. Like it's just
shot. I mean, that's the tough part for me. When it's like almost the exact same shot in two different movies.
It's kind of like it's almost like his signature, though. It's kind of like, you know, the way Nolan does how Nolan's scores pair up with his films. You know, like you can basically pick out a Nolan movie from the score alone.
That's because there's always a giant.
Exactly. Right. Yeah. In all of his movies. And so like, some guys just kind of have signatures like that. That's
absolutely.
Well, he has so many that I just don't. I'm over it. Like between his like Christianity references, like constantly, and, you know, using similar shots in almost every movie, you know, it's a lot. I still love Zack Snyder, and I think he's a great visual director, but there is some stuff about him that I have become sick of over the years, unfortunately. So we'll see if that continues in the Snyder cut, because we're reviewing that next week, and we're all very excited about it, right?
I am.
Like, the idea that a movie is getting re-released as its intention, like, I think it sets a very odd precedent, and if this is at all profitable, we are going to see Lucas have a field day. He's going to re-edit everything he's ever made. Well,
no, I mean,
American Graffiti.
Well, he sold all of his Star Wars rights, so Disney would have to hire him to do that. But I mean, I think what's weird here is, like, don't get me wrong, this obviously the Snyder Cut sets a completely new precedent, but it's also such a unique situation that there aren't a lot of other examples where this could even occur. And so I think that's where things get really weird, is that, like, I don't even know what's another example, assuming a studio was on board, what would be another film that could have something like this?
Yeah.
You know, it gets kind of weird.
I can't think of any, yeah.
Right? Like, there's the Schumacher cut of Batman Forever, but he passed away. You know, so he can't even do it now. So that's not an option. And it still isn't the same thing, because this is a situation where a director and producer stepped away and they brought in somebody else who reshot most of the movie and yada, yada, yada. So it's such a weird situation that I don't know that, good or bad, there's anybody else out there who could do it.
No, that's fair.
Yeah. They did announce that there is a 30-minute kind of behind the scenes documentary that's launching on March 18th as well, alongside of the cut. So if 4 hours and 2 minutes is not quite enough Snyder cut for you, they can tack on another half an hour.
So maybe we should remind the schedule of what the schedule is next week, just to
sure. be clear. Yeah, so next week, so March 22nd, Monday, March 22nd, we are doing a live stream of our review and in-depth discussion of Zack Snyder's Justice League, known as the Snyder Cut. All
and
4 hours.
It may be long.
Yeah, it's probably, I mean, I would imagine it, if it doesn't go long, that's a pretty bad sign. It means it was just boring as hell. So that's what we're doing on Monday. It's going to release the following day on March 23rd. Also on March 23rd, we are going to have a live stream of the of our review in-depth conversation of the premiere for The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, the latest MCU series coming to Disney Plus. So Snyder Cut drops on March 18th. Falcon and the Winter Soldier drops on March 19th. So we're doing them back-to-back days and releasing two episodes next week. So I hope that you join us for at least one of those episodes. I'd love for you to join in for both, but I understand if they're not, you know, both your cup of tea, but hopefully you enjoy at least one of them.
Yes. And if you join our Facebook group, you get to talk about fun stuff like these with us. I posted a poll in our group earlier today asking which movie or TV show people are going to watch first, The Falcon and Winter Soldier or Snyder Cut. And Falcon and Winter Soldier won by a good amount. And that may be because people don't have the time to devote 4 hours to a movie before they watch the hour long or 45 minute long or however long Falcon Winter Soldier is going to be. So,
yeah, I definitely think Falcon Winter Soldier is certainly easier to watch on a Friday night, you know, than the Snyder Cut is on a Thursday night or something like that. I definitely believe that. I did do a poll on Twitter asking people if they are going to watch the Snyder Cut this week on HBO Max. And we did have 67% said yes, and 17% said no, but they will later, just not this week. So only 8% said no at all. Some were undecided. So people are at least planning to watch it. I guess, you know, we'll see what happens. Obviously,
I think everybody's just like on board to watch this. They're like, maybe some of them are like, I'm going to hate this. And yeah, they're watching it.
If they go in hating it, then they're going to hate it. Like, I have this theory.
Then it's their problem. Like, if you know you're going to hate something or you expect to hate something, why are you going to dedicate 4 hours to it? It sounds very masochistic.
I mean, some people, I think, just want to, you know, shit on other people. Like, for example, earlier this week there was supposed to be a virtual premiere. Microsoft servers, there were some cloud issues, and so Microsoft Teams was down as a service, which meant that the premiere was delayed because it was a virtual premiere. And like, a lot of places covered that news, and I understand why, but the number of laugh reacts for people having a, you know, getting their jollies off on other people's time being ruined is just like a snapshot of like the whole situation, that people like when something sucks for somebody else. And that's just, it's demoralizing as hell. So I hope that if you watch the movie, I hope you enjoy it. I hope it's good. And if you don't, I'm sorry. I hope you don't feel like you wasted your time. But, you know, if you didn't like it, don't purposely try and make fun of people who did.
That's my problem. Like, if somebody's gonna like it. If you want to hate something and you want to sit through it yourself, that's on you. But, like, you can't be, like, what's the problem with just having opinions and letting it go about stuff? Like, just let it go.
Yeah. I mean, there's plenty of movies I dislike. If you've listened to the show, you know, like, we've trashed plenty of movies on the show. You're welcome to your opinion, but, you know, don't dog on individuals who happen to like the thing you don't.
Right.
Okay, so with that,
we're out of here.
We are out of here. So we are Screen Heroes. Thank you for joining us. You can find us at Screen Heroes Pod on all of the social medias, including our Facebook page, and join our Facebook group, the Screen Heroes Podcast Forum on Facebook. We do polls, memes, news, tournaments, all kinds of fun stuff. So join us there. You can find our show pretty much on every podcast app that's out there. You can also stream it directly from DericoStudios.com. You can find me at The Star Trek Dude out on Twitter. You can find Ray where?
The Siren Ray on Twitter.
And Ryan
at Buster Props on Twitter.
And that's us.
Buster Props.
No, it's just, I think it's just at Buster Props.
Yeah, it's a joke because you said the Star Trek Dude and I said the Siren Ray.
Oh, but I actually have the in my handle.
All right, guys. Fuck me. We'll see you all later.
Good night, everybody. Have a good week.